Chapter 3. Kemsa Uses Magic. In the confusion that reigned in the fortress while the guard was being turned out, no one noticed that the girl who had accompanied the Devi slipped out the great arched gate and vanished in the darkness. She ran straight for the city, her garments tucked high. She did not follow the open road, but cut straight through fields and over slopes, avoiding fences and leaping irrigation ditches as surely as if it were broad daylight and as easily as if she were a trained masculine runner. The hoof drum of the guardsmen had faded away up the hill before she reached the city wall. She did not go to the great gate, beneath whose arch men leaned on spears and craned their necks into the darkness, discussing the unwanted activity about the fortress. She skirted the wall until she reached a certain point where the spire of the tower was visible above the battlements. Then she placed her hands to her mouth and voiced a low, weird call that carried strangely. Almost instantly, a head appeared at an embrasure, and a rope came wriggling down the wall. She seized it, placed a foot in the loop at the end, and waved her arm. Then, quickly and smoothly, she was drawn up the sheer stone curtain. An instant later, she scrambled over the merlons and stood up on a flat roof which covered a house that was built against the wall. There was an open trap there, and a man in a camel-hair robe who silently coiled the rope, not showing in any way the strain of hauling a full-grown woman up a 40-foot wall.
"Where is Kerim Shah?"
she gasped, panting after her long run.
"Asleep in the house below. You have news?"
"Conan has stolen the Devi out of the fortress and carried her away into the hills,"
she blurted out her news in a rush, the words stumbling over each other. Kemsa showed no emotion, but merely nodded his turbaned head.
"Kerim Shah will be glad to hear that," he said.
"Wait!"
The girl threw her supple arms about his neck. She was panting hard, but not only from exertion. Her eyes blazed like black jewels in the starlight. Her upturned face was close to Kemsa's, but though he submitted to her embrace, he did not return it.
"Do not tell the Hyrcanian," she panted. "Let us use this knowledge ourselves. The governor has gone into the hills with his riders, but he might as well chase a ghost. He has not told anyone it was the Devi who was kidnapped. None in Peshkori or the fort knows it except us."
"But what good does it do us?" the man expostulated. "My master sent me with Kerim Shah to aid him in every way."
"Aid yourself," she cried fiercely. "Shake off your yoke."
"You mean disobey my masters?"
he gasped, and she felt his whole body turn cold under her arms.
"Ay!"
She shook him in the fury of her emotions.
"You too are a magician. Why will you be a slave, using your powers only to elevate others? Use your arts for yourself."
"That is forbidden."
He was shaking as if with an ague.
"I am not one of the Black Circle. Only by the command of the masters do I dare to use the knowledge they have taught me."
"But you can use it,"
she argued passionately.
"Do as I beg you. Of course Conan has taken the Devi to hold as hostage against the 7 tribesmen in the governor's prison. Destroy them so Chunder Shan cannot use them to buy back the Devi. Then let us go into the mountains and take her from the Afghulis. They cannot stand against your sorcery with their knives. The treasure of the Vendian kings will be ours as ransom. Then we can have it in our hands, and we can trick them and sell her to the king of Turan. We shall have wealth beyond our maddest dreams. With it we can buy warriors. We will take Korbul, oust the Turanians from the hills, and send our hosts southward, become king and queen of an empire."
Kemsa, too, was panting, shaking like a leaf in her grasp. His face showed gray in the starlight, beaded with great drops of perspiration.
"I love you,"
she cried fiercely, writhing her body against his, almost strangling him in her wild embrace, shaking him in her abandon.
"I will make a king of you. For love of you I betrayed my mistress. For love of me, betray your masters. Why fear the Black Seers? By your love for me, you have broken one of their laws already. Break the rest. You are as strong as they."
A man of ice could not have withstood the searing heat of her passion and fury. With an inarticulate cry, he crushed her to him, bending her backward and showering gasping kisses on her face, eyes, and lips.
"I'll do it."
His voice was thick with laboring emotions. He staggered like a drunken man.
"The arts they have taught me shall work for me, not my masters. We shall be rulers of the world, of the world.
Come, then."
Twisting lithely out of his embrace, she seized his hand and led him toward the trapdoor.
First we must make sure that the governor does not exchange those 7 Afghulis for the Devi.
He moved like a man in a daze until they had descended the ladder and she paused in the chamber below. Kerim Shah lay on a couch, motionless, an arm across his face as though to shield his sleeping eyes from the soft light of a brass lamp. She plucked Kemsa's arm and made a quick gesture across her own throat. Kemsa lifted his hand, then his expression changed and he drew away.
"I have eaten his salt,"
he muttered.
"Besides, he cannot interfere with us."
He led the girl through a door that had opened on a winding stair. After their soft tread had faded into silence, the man on the couch sat up. Kerim Shah wiped the sweat from his face. A knife thrust he did not fear, but he feared Kemsa as a man fears a poisonous reptile.
"People who plot on roofs should remember to lower their voices," he muttered. "But as Kemsa has turned against his masters, and as he was my only contact with them, I can count on their aid no longer. From now on I play the game in my own way."
Rising to his feet, he went quickly to a table, drew pen and parchment from his girdle, and scribbled a few succinct lines.
"To Korsu Khan, governor of Secunderam. The Cimmerian Conan has carried the Devi Yasmina to the villages of the Afghulis. It is an opportunity to get the Devi into our hands, as the king has so long desired. Send 3,000 horsemen at once. I will meet them in the valley of Gurashah with native guides."
And he signed it with a name that was not in the least like Kerim Shah. Then from a golden cage he drew forth a carrier pigeon, to whose leg he made fast the parchment, rolled into a tiny cylinder and secured with gold wire. Then he went quickly to a casement and tossed the bird into the night. It wavered on fluttering wings, balanced, and was gone like a flitting shadow. Catching up helmet, sword, and cloak, Kerim Shah hurried out of the chamber and down the winding stair. The prison quarters of Peshkori were separated from the rest of the city by a massive wall, in which was set a single iron-bound door under an arch. Over the arch burned a lurid red cresset, and beside the door stood, or squatted, a warrior with shield and spear. This warrior, leaning on his spear and yawning from time to time, suddenly started to his feet. He had not thought he had dozed, but a man was standing before him, a man he had not heard approach. The man wore a camel-hair robe and a green turban. In the flickering light of the cresset his features were shadowy, but a pair of lambent eyes shone surprisingly in the lurid glow.
"Who comes?" demanded the warrior, presenting his spear. "Who are you?"
The stranger did not seem perturbed, though the spear point touched his bosom. His eyes held the warrior's with strange intensity.
"What are you obliged to do?"
he asked strangely.
"To guard the gate."
The warrior spoke thickly and mechanically. He stood rigid as a statue, his eyes slowly glazing.
"You lie. You are obliged to obey me. You have looked into my eyes, and your soul is no longer your own. Open the door."
Stiffly, with the wooden features of an image, the guard wheeled about, drew a great key from his girdle, turned it in the massive lock, and swung open the door. Then he stood at attention, his unseeing stare straight ahead of him. A woman glided from the shadows and laid an eager hand on the mesmerist's arm.
"Bid him fetch us horses, Kemsa," she whispered.
"No need of that," answered the Raksha.
Lifting his voice slightly, he spoke to the guardsman.
"I have no more use for you. Kill yourself."
Like a man in a trance, the warrior thrust the butt of his spear against the base of the wall and placed the keen head against his body just below the ribs. Then, slowly, stolidly, he leaned against it with all his weight so that it transfixed his body and came out between his shoulders. Sliding down the shaft, he lay still, the spear jutting above him at its full length, like a horrible stalk growing out of his back. The girl stared down at him in morbid fascination until Kemsa took her arm and led her through the gate. Torches lighted a narrow space between the outer wall and a lower inner one, in which were arched doors at regular intervals. A warrior paced this enclosure, and when the gate opened he came sauntering up, so secure in his knowledge of the prison's strength that he was not suspicious until Kemsa and the girl emerged from the doorway. Then it was too late. The Raksha did not waste time in hypnotism, though his actions savored of magic to the girl. The guard lowered his spear threateningly, opening his mouth to shout an alarm that would bring spearmen swarming out of the guardrooms at either end of the alleyway. Kemsa flicked the spear aside with his left hand, as a man might flick a straw, and his right flashed out and back, seeming gently to caress the warrior's neck in passing. And the guard pitched on his face without a sound, his head lolling on a broken neck. Kemsa did not glance at him, but went straight to one of the arched doors and placed his open hand against the heavy bronze lock. With a rending shudder, the portal buckled inward. As the girl followed him through, she saw that the thick teak wood hung in splinters, the bronze bolts were bent and twisted from their sockets, and the great hinges broken and disjointed. A 1,000-pound battering ram with 40 men to swing it could have shattered the barrier no more completely. Kemsa was drunk with the freedom and the exercise of his power, glorying in his might and flinging his strength about as a young giant exercises his thews with unnecessary vigor in the exultant pride of his prowess. The broken door let them into a small courtyard, lit by a cresset. Opposite the door was a wide grill of iron bars. A hairy hand was visible gripping one of these bars, and in the darkness behind them glimmered the whites of eyes. Kemsa was silent for a space, gazing into the shadows from which those glimmering eyes gave back his stare with burning intensity. Then his hand went into his robe, and from his opening fingers a shimmering feather of sparkling dust sifted to the flags. Instantly a flare of green fire lighted the enclosure. In the brief glare the forms of 7 men, standing motionless behind the bars, were limned in vivid detail. Tall, hairy men in ragged hillman's garments. They did not speak, but in their eyes blazed the fear of death, and their hairy fingers gripped the bars. The fire died out, but the glow remained a quivering ball of lambent green that pulsed and shimmered on the flags before Kemsa's feet. The wide gaze of the tribesmen was fixed upon it. It wavered, elongated, turned into a luminous green smoke spiraling upward. It twisted and writhed like a great shadowy serpent, then broadened and billowed out into shining folds and whirls. It grew to a cloud moving silently over the flags, straight toward the grill. The men watched its coming with dilated eyes. The bars quivered with the grip of their desperate fingers. Bearded lips parted, but no sound came forth. The green cloud rolled on the bars and blotted them from sight, like a fog it oozed within the grill and hid the men within. From the enveloping folds came a strangled gasp as of a man plunged suddenly under the surface of water. That was all. Kemsa touched the girl's arm as she stood with parted lips and dilated eyes. Mechanically, she turned away with him, looking back over her shoulder. Already the mist was thinning. Close to the bars, she saw a pair of sandaled feet, the toes turned upward. She glimpsed the indistinct outlines of 7 still, prostrate shapes.
"And now for a steed swifter than the fastest horse ever bred in mortal stable," Kemsa was saying. "We will be in Afghulistan before dawn."